This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 2008, Pamela White began writing a book called The Genius of Marion. The subject, her mother, the accomplished painter Marion Williams Steele, who suffered from Alzheimer's before she died in 2001. A year later, Pam was herself diagnosed with the disease. She was then 61. Pam's son, Banker White, filmed the early stages of his mother's decline. Here is Pam talking to her doctor in 2001.
And can you tell me what year it is?
This is the one that makes me mad, because it's something I should know immediately.
That's tough, yeah. I know.
Tell me again.
What year is it?
19-something.
Okay.
Banker White's documentary film, The Genius of Marion, is an intimate, sometimes heartbreaking portrait of a family watching the mother that they knew overtaken by Alzheimer's. The film makes its television debut as the season opener for PBS's POV series on September 8th. And the filmmaker Banker White joins us with more. Banker, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So when did this story turn into a film for you?
That's a really good question, because, you know, when my mom was officially diagnosed, that came after about 4 years of confusion, of just kind of wondering what was going on with her. I lived in San Francisco and there in the Boston area. And, you know, every time I came home, would really try and check in with her. And when she was officially diagnosed, after conversations with my dad, I just felt like it was important that I try and move home and see what kind of support I could offer. So I did that in the fall of 2009. And I probably filmed with her for more than a year before I admitted really to myself and then began a dialogue with everyone that I thought that this was incredibly powerful material. And I kind of started to have a different conversation with my mom initially about making the film. Mm. I'm the only grandson of Marion's who identifies as being an artist. She was just a real hero to me. So to be with my mother talking about this woman who was so important to me, and in a way like inching towards talking about my mom's diagnosis because it was still very difficult for her. Mm. So since Marion had Alzheimer's, we could kind of very carefully get into that territory. And throughout the year, my mom opened up and started speaking to me quite openly about what it felt like to be diagnosed.
Let's get first to your mother's very full, interesting life. Tell us a little bit about her history.
She was and is an incredibly beautiful woman. And she was a stage actress, and in her kind of later teens and 20s was a model. And she did everything from runways to print catalogs and television. A lot of people actually, there's a clip of her selling Aerodextra Dry in the film. And a lot of people who have actually reached out to me who've seen the film, and the first thing they say is, I remember that commercial.
I'm a fashion model, and when you have to change 7 or more times in 45 minutes, you really need added protection. And because of this, I use Aerodextra Dry.
And then as my mom became a mother and I was born, she transitioned out of being a model and went to school for social work. And I think was an incredibly gifted social worker and therapist. And then, of course, kind of skipped the most important part. She was an incredible mother, very supportive of her three children.
Well, I certainly felt a lot of identification with the pain of it and the powerfulness and also the sense of seeing positivity. My mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's a little more than a year ago. She's much older than your mom. But this idea of seeing somebody who was once the glue and the caretaker, and this is clear in your family, who becomes the one who needs to be driven around and watched and changed. We see your mother unable to spell her name. She can no longer remember phone numbers. She at one scene puts a coat on and off and on and off and looks lost, but she is kind of aware and unaware of what's happening to her. But you know, you're a filmmaker watching these scenes, taking this footage and watching these scenes over and over and over again. What was that like for you?
She is the type of person that has spent so much of her life and really identified as someone who helped others, that you never really worried about her needing help from us. And I mean, almost to the point of it being a fault, where I wouldn't say that she ever had a false smile, but she was so together that it was easy for her to project an incredibly positive energy onto any situation, mm-hmm. which I think is really healing. I don't look at that as denial. I think the idea that I'll just use that smile, her smile, as it being a source of optimism, I think that it's healing, and it's both of these things. But when it is kind of trying to cover up the really intense embarrassment, mm-hmm. The shame, mm-hmm. but in the beginning, I think it was more emotional. It was actually that awareness that you're talking about. It was watching her struggle with something. It's easy to walk up and lend a helping hand, and everything moves forward beautifully. We're all a tight, loving family, and we have a nice support network of friends. But when you offer help, and that offer to care for this person who's clearly struggling actually somehow offends them or saddens them, that was the most difficult thing.
I want to pick up on that doctor's visit that we heard a little bit from earlier, when your father's basically saying, you know, I'm not so good at this, and your mom is resisting getting outside help.
There are just some things I'm not that good at. You know, I don't know how to put your makeup on.
Mm. You're really good at it.
Yeah, that's what you say. I do dress you, but I'm not that good at it. Uh-huh. You know, the showers and the baths and mm-hmm. all that stuff is... Mm-hmm. You could really get better help than me, mm-hmm. but that's the big issue.
Uh-huh.
That I think the problem is that it's kind of like my, how do you say it? Pride.
But your father really bears the brunt of the caregiving. There's with a lot of sweetness and generosity, but we also get little glimpses of his frustration as he tries to keep her active. And this shows up particularly in one scene. He wants to bring her out on the boat. It's a windy day. She just doesn't want to go. And you ask her, you know, to describe what's happening or describe the scene, and she calls it hell. Let's hear a little bit more.
What do I do?
Just come over here, hold my hand, and step in the boat.
I don't want to.
Oh, all right, let's just go sit in our asses for the rest of our life. Jesus Christ. Come on, Mom. Here, I'll bring you right back if it's terrible.
So, powerful scene from the film The Genius of Marianne. Banker White is with us. He's the director of the film, and he was there. And we hear you sort of trying to cheer the whole process along. You know, the role that you're playing, and you're witnessing as a filmmaker, but you also have to, as a filmmaker, show us all of the lapses, right? You know, you have to communicate to us, like, the worst. I'm just wondering about how your family felt about seeing themselves at not necessarily their best moments.
In terms of the relationship with the family, I think that it's really constant communication, and that you, for example, I went to the doctor with my mom and dad multiple times. Sometimes as a son, but I did also ask to film. And there's clear communication about that beforehand. So when you do go and film what is kind of real life in that more observational role, there's this foundation of trust, and I'm not kind of storming in to rooms with a camera blazing without having had some prior discussion with everybody about it. But then with a situation like this, of course, and the length of time that I was there, and I think also just the level of comfort that they have with me, people become unaware of the camera. So you are able to film things that are a reflection of, you know, real life. And so I filmed lots of times when people became frustrated in that boat scene. I think in some ways it's because my dad's trying so hard mm-hmm. to go. I mean, it's like this Clark Griswold kind of... a darker version of that, maybe, when he's trying. I mean, it was like literally, it was like right before Hurricane Sandy. It was like early fall. It was not a beautiful boat date, to say the least, and getting on the boat is something that my mom's never liked to do. But I do think represents very much this idea that we're going and we're doing it as a family, and this is the thing that we always used to do, so let's continue to do it. And as you're saying, I'm there not just filming it, but encouraging her, because in the house, I just was like, my dad needs this. We need to do this. It's true. My mom, she's just been sitting on the couch for a week. We need to go and all. It's so easy to believe that it's the right thing to do. And so it's a great example of what it feels like to be in a you know, for my dad, a love relationship with someone who's changing.
Hmm. How about your mom? What did she think of the film?
I think the question of whether she was aware is not a, it's difficult to answer that question in terms of, it's not a yes or no answer. And that's true not just of her awareness of something like a film festival, but all aspects of her life. What I do know is that she had very positive experiences at every public screening of the film. We watched the film in a close-to-finish state multiple times and communicated well about it. She'd say little things like, I think this is good. Hmm. I think this is a good thing. Isn't this a good thing? And I know as a son you want to hear that because you want to believe that she believes that sharing these things is a good thing. But you also want to believe that there is that kind of awareness, though she's paralyzed in other ways with her use of language and access to memories is very difficult. Even today, she has these little nuggets of insight, and you wonder where it came from because she seemed not like you hadn't accessed that part of her for a long time. And so there's something about intense social energy, large groups of people being focused on one thing, where so far the being present at the screenings has been a very positive experience. You know, people hugging her in the lobby afterwards. It's all been positive.
Yeah. Well, Banker White, I want to thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much.
Banker and his wife and producing partner, Anna Fitch, made the documentary film The Genius of Marion. It's going to be making its television debut as the season opener for PBS's POV series on September 8th. You can see a trailer on our website, wordofmouthradio.org, but there's also a big storytelling component where people can share their own stories of dealing with Alzheimer's and their family at thegeniusofmarion.com. We'll have a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, a scientist makes a remarkable discovery about plants and their ability to communicate with one another. We'll bring you that story after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the late 60s and early 70s, just as the environmental movement was gaining momentum, a sort of new age ecology entered the mainstream. And the idea that, hey, plants are people too, man, formed a kind of rallying point for the counterculture. But there were repercussions in the scientific world. Peter Frick Wright and Robbie Carver from the podcast 30 Minutes West have the story of one scientist from the period whose groundbreaking discovery could not have come at a worse time.
Say what you will about the 70s, it was an open-minded time. And when The Secret Life of Plants was published, pop culture took note.
At the beginning of the hippie movement, a crazy idea took root.
Turns out, plants feel pain.
In a book to be called The Secret Life of Plants, Mr. Peter Tompkins. Mr. Tompkins, what exactly are these experiments in America about the sensitivity of plants?
Well, the first one was very interesting. A lie detector expert of the CIA put his machine on a plant and found that he could communicate with a plant.
Supposedly scientific and an immediate bestseller, the book claimed plants were sentient, emotional creatures.
Are you pulling my leg?
Not at all. Not at all.
But to plant scientists, it was a joke. This was junk science, and they were busy working on feeding people. The book was quickly debunked.
Because science is about facts and supporting evidence.
To scientists, plants were mostly food. Here's UC Davis professor Rick Carbon.
Largely, the notion was that plants didn't change much. Plants didn't respond. They didn't behave. They just sat there in one place. They were victims.
Which brings us to David Rhodes, a researcher at the University of Washington who had PhDs in both organic chemistry and zoology and saw plants differently.
David was an Englishman. He was a relatively large, slightly portly man with a fringe of wild curly hair.
This is Jack Schultz. He was a grad student with Rhodes and now runs a lab at the University of Missouri. Rhodes' first big idea was that natural selection should favor the assertive plant. It didn't make sense that they'd go through life just waiting to be eaten. They should have evolved some tools to deal with their challenges. He started looking into it and was part of a group that showed that plants change their internal chemistry in response to attack, adding toxins to their leaves when, say, the very hungry caterpillar comes munching along. And in the course of following up on those experiments, he got some results that defined the rest of his career.
He was comparing two sets of willow trees that were growing outdoors.
One set he was attacking with insects, inducing trees' defenses by manually placing caterpillars on their leaves.
And the other set was the control set with no insects.
He took leaves from both sets of trees back to the lab and fed them to different caterpillars to see if the tree's toxins made any difference. And they did. It actually gave the caterpillars diarrhea. But weirdly, some caterpillars eating leaves from the control group were also struggling. His eventual explanation turned traditional plant science on its head. When attacked, these trees released volatile chemicals into the air that warned their neighbors. They were communicating.
Right away I saw we had a crazy story here, and I combed the literature for any evidence that plants could perceive other plants, you know, chemically in this way, and I couldn't find any at all.
Plants shouldn't have been able to do this. Rhodes was reimagining 100 years of conventional thinking. And there was no trail of breadcrumbs leading him to the discovery. He just saw it. And in the summer of 1982, he presented the idea at an American Chemical Society conference.
And then everything hit the fan. I don't think anybody remembers anything else that was said at that meeting.
Schultz and another postdoc, Ian Baldwin, moved to Dartmouth and designed a cleaner experiment in the lab that got similar results. Together, the two papers became known as Talking Trees, which made for even better headlines.
I just remember how the phone was ringing. I mean, it was really... Woo!
Gordon Oriens ran the lab where Rhodes did this experiment.
None of us considered it to be talking trees, but this is, you know, when the press gets a hold of something like this, it gets blown up that way.
Are plants capable of communicating with each other? New studies.
In fact, they were entering a minefield, because talking trees sounded a lot like the New Agey stuff that had just been debunked.
Mrs. Hashimoto looks forward to actual conversation with her cactus.
The secret life of plants really hurt things because, especially in the scientific community, of course, it was regarded as nonsense. And, you know, this really looked like it was ripped from the pages of that book.
It was a problem of language. Both Rhodes and The Secret Life of Plants were saying plants could communicate. But Rhodes was talking about chemicals, not feelings. Still, it sent the field looking for weaknesses. The eminent British scientist Sir John Lawton called the experiments more likely a transfer of diseases, or root-to-root connections. It was a bit of a death blow. And to make matters worse, Rhodes began having trouble replicating his results.
As far as I'm aware, there was nothing flawed in the experiments. Under the conditions and the trees that he had in the situations, it didn't show up.
Sometimes it worked, but not every time. These talking trees weren't much for conversation. After a few years, the grants disappeared and the money dried up. Pretty soon he was running out of options and took a job teaching organic chemistry at a community college.
He ultimately gave up and left science.
In the late 90s, Rhodes was diagnosed with terminal cancer. He took his own life in 2002.
What's kind of ironic is that I think I know why he didn't get repeatable results. He was doing experiments with trees like Douglas firs in the spring, and then, you know, he would analyze the data and then repeat the experiment in the fall. And we have since discovered that mature leaves don't respond to insects attacking them. But he just didn't realize that at certain times of the year the trees wouldn't talk back.
Even though his experiments have now been replicated and his theories confirmed, Rhodes has been mostly forgotten. It's really hard to find his original paper. But it turns out his discovery was just the tip of the iceberg.
Well, since that plant communication thing, people started looking for cool things plants could do that they hadn't considered before.
Scientists have now shown that some plants share resources through networks of underground fungi. Most acknowledge their own family, and they'll summon insects to eat whatever's eating them, based on the saliva of their attacker. There's evidence that plants have a kind of hearing. They'll react to the sound of a caterpillar munching on leaves. And they even have a sort of vision. Plants grow faster when photoreceptors in their leaves sense that they're surrounded by too much green. Of course, we still have the same language problems. The words vision and hearing are the first steps down that same slippery slope.
How wide is the gulf between man and plant, if there is a gulf at all?
It's not vision, and it's not hearing. It's an entirely different evolutionary strategy. Talking about plants as if they're people says more about us than it does about what plants actually do. There's a huge conversation going on, and we're just now learning how to tune in and listen. Plants are in direct communication with pollinators, pests, herbivores, and each other. If not for Rhodes, it might actually still be a secret.
And this story was produced by Peter Frick-Wright and Robbie Carver from the podcast 30 Minutes West. It's part of the PRX STEM Story Project, made possible by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. Up next, a social psychologist explains why the pursuit of a soulmate may not only be unrealistic, but actually damaging to a relationship. We'll hear that story after the news when Word of Mouth continues on NHPR. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Romantic comedies specialize in glorifying the ideal of the perfect couple, soulmates, true love.
True love, you heard him? You could not ask for a more noble cause than that.
Yes, honey, true love is the greatest thing in the world. Except for nice MLT.
The actors Mandy Patinkin and Billy Crystal from the 1987 film The Princess Bride. Its plot relies heavily on the concept of true love being the greatest thing in the world. While stories about true love may be great for selling tickets, the popular concept of discovering your soulmate may not be the best for your relationship. Spike W.S. Lee is an assistant professor of marketing at the University of Toronto. He's co-author of a new paper published in the September issue of the Journal of Experimental Psychology just about this concept of soulmate. And Spike, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So did Miracle Max get it wrong? True love is not the greatest thing?
I think it depends on what you want to look at. If you look, I mean, when we're talking about relationships, there's all kinds of relationship outcomes that you can look at. You can look at long-term relationship satisfaction, divorce rate, or when relationship just starts, you know, at the beginning stage, how excited do you feel? It turns out in our research, when we look at long-term relationship satisfaction, the idea of soulmates is not exactly the helpful one.
Okay, let's go through that a little bit. You and your colleague Norbert Schwartz evaluated the effect of how couples framed their relationship on their relationship outcomes. Please, what were you looking to find out?
I was looking to find out if I was right, you know, research as me-search. So the way we tested this idea of framing love is to look at two different, what we call metaphorical frames of love. Now, there are all kinds of ways that people think about romantic relationship, two of them being what we call love as a perfect fit or love as a journey. In the perfect fit frame, the basic idea is that my romantic partner and I, we were made for each other. Mm-hmm. So there's this idea of idyllic state. There should be perfect harmony, as if two halves of a circle come together and form this unity frame. But the idea of love as a journey is rather different. It basically frames your relationship as an ongoing process, as something that unfolds over time, as if there was a destination ahead of you and you're going through perhaps ups and downs, twists and turns to finally reach that destination.
So destiny versus destination on some level.
Ah, nicely put.
How did you evaluate these relationships and their effect on outcomes?
In one of the studies, we did something quite subtle. We gave people a bunch of, remember in high school, if you took biology, the enzymes and substrates, the lock and key, you know, mm-hmm. The two.
Yeah.
So they have to fit, right? The shapes have to match. So we gave people a page, basically, of 10 locks on the left and 10 keys on the right. They just have to find the right match, basically, and then, you know, match them together. That's one condition. That's the love as perfect fit condition, except that we don't actually activate love at all. It's simply the idea of perfect fit activated in a subtle way. In another condition, we give people a piece of paper with four mazes on them. Just, you know, draw from point A to point B through a maze to activate the idea of a journey. It turns out if people have been primed with the idea of journey, they are less bothered by their relationship conflicts. In other words, if they have relationship conflicts, they tend to feel dissatisfied with the relationship. That's you know, no-brainer. But if they have been primed with the idea of journey, they are not dissatisfied with their relationship, even though they have thought about conflicts.
So summarize the findings for us, if you would. People who thought that they had this missing piece, this other half, this soulmate part of themselves, how did they look at relationship conflict versus those who felt like their life, their love was a journey and that there was a destination ahead of them?
Sure. So let me clarify that piece of the research. We asked people to tell us two conflicts they had with their partner recently, right? Or two celebrations they had with their partner recently. So either positive or negative relationship experiences. Afterwards, we simply asked people to tell us, hey, how satisfied are you with how the relationship is going these days? Now, if they thought about conflicts, then obviously they were less satisfied with the relationship than if they had thought about celebration. So no surprise whatsoever, except that before they thought about either conflicts or celebrations, if they had been primed to think about journey by drawing through the mazes, then they were actually not bothered by the conflicts at all.
Any thoughts as to why couples who believe that they are soulmates might have more trouble with conflict than those who think they're just on a journey together?
Yeah, I think it has to do with some unspoken assumptions about these two frames. When we frame an idea, often each frame highlights certain aspects and hides other aspects. This is what we call a highlighting and hiding mechanism. In the unity frame, what it highlights is the idea of perfect harmony. Now, perfect harmony means that you shouldn't really have any conflicts. If you had conflicts, you know, why if you had conflicts, it basically suggests that, well, we weren't really made for each other within the frame of perfect unity.
That's a pretty idealized vision of relationships, given that they're just work.
Mm-hmm, exactly. In fact, some people call the journey frame a work it out theory, a work it out hypothesis of a relationship. You know, there are things that you just have to work out in relationship. Even in the best of relationships, it's hard to imagine having zero conflict through 45 years of marriage or something, right? And so the journey idea, the journey frame, simply highlights the fact that it is a process. And notice the interesting implication here. In any journey, you have a destination. And that presumably is a good thing. So when you're going through these conflicts of difficulties, ups and downs, there's a sense in which that, yes, I'm going to persist. I'm going to work it out because there's something better lying ahead of us. And the journey itself becomes more meaningful. I mean, think about all the love fiction, right? If a love fiction was just, you know, oh, they were happy together, and that's basically no story to tell. All love fiction involves some sort of conflicts precisely because people generate meanings, extract meanings out of those experiences when these conflicts lead them to a higher plane in the relationship.
Then is there hope, Spike Lee, for couples who do think of each other as soulmates? Could they just reframe it in their minds? Would that be enough?
That's a great question. And let me try and clarify what I think the implication of this research is. Often people assume that what we're saying is that soulmates are hopeless. That's not necessarily what we want to claim because there are different relationship outcomes that you can look at. In our research, we focus mostly on relationship satisfaction in the long run. But after getting these findings that relationship as a journey seems to be helpful, more helpful than the relationship as a unity frame, I keep thinking, well, but people talk about love as a perfect fit all the time. I mean, it's such a popular idea. It cannot be a completely dysfunctional idea if it's so popular across cultures and languages. So what good might it do, this love as a perfect fit frame? And I thought, well, there's a couple of possibilities here. Perhaps at the early stage of a relationship, you do want to believe that this is a really good match. Your partner and you are a really good match. Otherwise, why would you invest efforts down the road you need that belief to get you going, basically. That's number one. And number two, I suspect that sexual intimacy and passion might be facilitated by the perfect fit idea. I mean, if you think about, you know, sexual intimacy, honestly, it is actually quite, you know, an instantiation of physical unity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so perhaps framing love as this unity will spark passion. It's just this passion alone, intimacy alone, aren't sufficient to keep relationship going. But it is part of relationship, and it's an important part of relationship as well.
So soulmates, other halves, maybe good in the beginning, maybe not so much for the long run.
That would be my bet. I don't have strong evidence to support that, but that's definitely my prediction.
Well, Spike Lee, thank you for the lessons in relationships, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having me. It's my pleasure.
Spike W.S. Lee, social psychologist who teaches marketing at the University of Toronto. His paper on how the concept of soulmates influences conflict in relationships appears in the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology. And we continue our unsweetened view of relationships with a closer look at matrimony in the modern world. Sex therapist Esther Perel explains the difficulties of reckoning the conflicting desires of stability and the erotic within a marriage. Mating in captivity, when word of mouth continues.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. For centuries, marriage functioned as a political, practical, and economic union, depending on your station in life. For the aristocrats, a good marriage secured fortunes and position. For common folk, it meant having enough kids to work a farm. It's only in the last 100 years or so that the idea of a passionate marriage took hold of the popular imagination. Today, most of us are less worried about basic survival and can focus more on what we desire in a union, usually a healthy, dynamic, secure relationship that is dependable, but not when it comes to sex, which people want to be anything but staid and predictable. Esther Perel has based her career on how to unite those conflicting desires. She's a psychologist, a sex therapist, and author who specializes in couples and sexuality. Her best-selling book is called Mating in Captivity, Unlocking Erotic Intelligence. And we spoke to her earlier this year.
Never before have we invested more in love as a part of marriage, as a constitutive part of marriage, and never have we divorced more in the name of the absence of that love. We have piled up expectations that we try to meet with one person to the extent that relationships sometimes crumble under the amount of expectations. We are asking one person to give us what we've always expected from long-term relationships or marriages: security, family life, companionship, social status, economic support. And we want that same person to also be our best friend and our trusted confidant and our passionate lover to boot. And we live twice as long. And that's a tall order for a party of two.
Yeah, that's an awful lot to put on a relationship. So there's this tension that a lot of couples have. What's driving that?
A few things are driving it, right? We are living in the West in a free world in which we have a market economy that doesn't just apply to finance, but also to romantic relationships, and in which the values of freedom and autonomy have become ultimate. We have today this concept of a passionate marriage, which used to be a contradiction in terms. Marriage was here and passion pretty much a privilege mostly for men that could experience it with far more safety than women, for whom the consequences were dire. And we want today one person and one relationship to give us two fundamental sets of human needs that are actually rather opposite and that spring from different sources and pull us in different directions, which is our need for security and our need for adventure. Or in systemic language, our need for stability and our need for growth and change. Mm. This is the first time in the history of humankind where we have sex not because we want multiple children or because it's exclusively a woman's marital duty. We want sex that is rooted in desire, that is the sovereign expression of our free will. I want it.
So how do you keep that desire alive when you have kids and a job and you're exhausted and you've made dinner and done dishes and get the kids bathed and negotiate all of these different responsibilities that stifle eroticism?
Or one could say they may not necessarily stifle the erotic, but they displace it. If you look at many modern families, I would say that often the erotic energy is alive and well. But for that, you have to think of eroticism not as sex and the narrow meaning that we have attributed to the erotic. If you think about novelty, imagination, playfulness, curiosity, mystery, as essential erotic ingredients, they are all present in a family with children, but it's often eros redirected. The kids get novel activities and the couple does the same old, same old. The question then becomes, how do people bring some of that energy back to the couple, and why does it matter? It matters because for most couples in the West today, the survival of the family depends on the reasonable contentment of the couple. So on the long list of what your children need, a couple that has an erotic bond should feature as one of the main items.
Mm. It sounds to me like that's about intimacy. That's about living a life together. But you write that intimacy doesn't necessarily mean good sex. And I'd love to hear more about that, because current thinking tells us that the two are intrinsically combined. I mean, it sounds like what couples therapists say to keep people together.
Yes. For me, intimacy, first of all, is a concept that has profoundly changed its meaning. It used to be a convivencia, a living together, a sharing of the daily, a raising of the children, a working of the land, attachment and habit. Intimacy today is a deep experience of recognition of my individuality, of my authentic self, for which you are going to be a validating, reflective listener that's going to help me transcend my existential aloneness. That is a very different kind of intimacy. Now, its connection to sexuality is highly questioned. If mutuality and reciprocity and protection and worry about the well-being of our partner and a sense of responsibility are part of the experience of love, then sometimes the very experience of responsibility, worry, and protection can be sexually deflating.
Your concept of intimacy also involves an idea of privacy. So tell us a little bit about this idea of personal intimacy.
Personal intimacy is the experience of interiority, of an inner world with oneself. What's interesting is that we live in the age of transparency, in which the same concept of intimacy has become equated with transparent, with wholesale sharing. We are close because we can tell each other everything, rather than we are close maybe because we don't have to tell each other everything, because we know that we have worlds and parts of us that remain personal and private.
We're speaking with the psychologist and author Esther Perel about how to keep long-term relationships fresh, let's say, and healthy. Esther, you talked about the importance of personal intimacy, but what about using that concept as a right to unmitigated privacy or a justification for having an affair? Are you saying in some cases that infidelity can be okay?
Look, the question of what is separate and what is together is a fundamental question that belongs to the making of any couple. Every couple decides what is separate and what is common, what thoughts need to be shared, what finances need to be shared, what fantasies need to be shared, and what remains personal, what friends can remain your own and what friends have to be joined, what movies you can see on your own, or if you have to see only the movies that both of us want to see. This is an organizing principle of any intimate relationship. The difference between heterosexual couples maybe and homosexual couples is that in straight couples, there is an assumption that is made up front so that the question is rarely negotiated, certainly not in the sexual realm, because that threatens the sacred ideal of the romantic myth. What you're asking me is to take something that is a lot more ambiguous and a lot more complex and make determinations that have never been able to be made.
Let's talk about something a little more concrete that you found from people when you traveled around the world on your book tour and asked people, when do you find yourself most drawn to your partner? I'm interested to hear what you found.
You know, it's a question that I originally asked. I've asked it in about 22 countries. Mating in Captivity is translated in about 25 languages. And I thought there must be major cultural differences. And except for one answer that is gender-based, which is when the women say, when I see him playing with the children, which is very sexy and not the other way around, none of the answers are gender-bound. They cross back and forth. But they basically organize themselves in four groups of answers. One would be when I am separated from my partner, when he or she is away, when we reunite, mm-hmm. highlighting the notion that desire also is rooted in absence and in longing. So that's the first group of answers, which we could elaborate. The second one was when I see my partner doing something that he or she is competent about, passionate about, in their element, self-sufficient. Basically, when I see my partner as an other, separate from me, that I do not need to take care of. And that experience of a radiant other, where there is no caretaking and no sense of responsibility, is highly charged with attraction, with desire, with admiration, which is an essential element of desire. The third group was when he or she or I, when we surprise each other, highlighting the notion of novelty, of breaking of routine, of the eruption of desire. And surprise could be going and doing something that's different from the usual, or seeing my partner as vulnerable, not because vulnerability is so attractive, but because I don't typically get to see my partner in that space. And then the other one was when we're on vacation, when the kids are not there, basically highlighting the playfulness, the open-endedness, the non-productive nature of erotic sex meaning sexuality that is transformed by our imagination, or the poetics of sex, basically. So these groups began to highlight that you look at this person that's already so familiar, and momentarily they are once again somewhat mysterious, somewhat unknown, somewhat elusive, and in that space between me and the other lies the erotic elan.
Mm. So, Esther Perel, with those things in mind, does a perfect marriage exist, or what does a really great marriage look like to you?
When I went around and asked, it's not about separate people living separate life at all, but it is about people who have a fundamental respect for the freedom, the existential freedom of another person. That is not the freedom to cheat and all of that, but basically the sense that you don't confuse intimacy with surveillance, and you don't confuse intimacy with fusion. It is a relationship where two people are able to continue to grow. You know, we used to die 7 years after we were done raising our kids. Today we have this phase where we say, is this it? And that thirst for feeling alive, which means that there is still surprise to come, that new things can still emerge, new experience we haven't known, that is what keeps us on the edge of our seats. It is the difference between not being dead and being alive. And I think that a thriving relationship very much focuses on that distinction.
Well, thank you for all of the surprises and inspiration today, Esther Perel. Really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Esther Perel, a psychotherapist and author who specializes in couples and sexuality. You can find more on her best-selling book, Mating in Captivity, Unlocking Erotic Intelligence, or a link to watch her TED Talk and much more at wordofmouthradio.org.
My funny Valentine.
Thanks so much for joining us today. Earlier in the show, we talked with social psychologist Spike Lee about the concept of true love and why placing a romantic partner on the soulmate pedestal could be damaging to a relationship.
What it highlights is the idea of perfect harmony. Now, perfect harmony means that you shouldn't really have any conflicts. If you had conflicts, it basically suggests that, well, we weren't really made for each other.
Perhaps you are among the 73% of Americans who believe in the concept of a soulmate. If so, Dr. Raymond Nee has developed a test to determine where individuals fall on the soulmate scale. You can take the test for yourself. It's on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. So glad to have you with us. And we will be back with more Word of Mouth Sunday at noon, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
But Don't change your hair for me. Not if you.